This week's show is sponsored in part by Altero Software, developers of virtual backup trusted by over 30,000 small and medium businesses. If you need an easy-to-use and affordable Hyper-V and VMware backup solution, try Altero VM Backup for 30 days. Head to go.altero.com/datanauts, and throughout the month of June, Datanauts listeners will get a free Altero t-shirt. Plus, after the 30-day trial, you can back up two VMs for free forever. One more time, that's go.altero.com/datanauts. This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code DATANAUTS30.
Have you ever been given a requirement that cannot be met until a prerequisite requirement is first met, which also requires the first requirement? I get it. That's a lot of the word requirement being thrown around. And also there's a name for that, a catch-22. And sizing workloads for your data center often falls into this realm because you don't know how big the environment needs to be until after you've deployed that application or that stack into production, unless you have a positronic brain, which we certainly don't have. This situation can lead to many facepalms and a general sense of blarg. Today, the Datanauts huddle around a virtual fireplace crackling away on our portable holo generator to discuss strategies and tactics around resource allocation. Hello, I'm Chris Wall. You can follow me at Chris Wall on the Twitters, and with me is my co-host who adamantly defends that if you lick a snozberry sticker, it will taste like a snozberry, Ethan Banks. He's at EC Banks on the Twitter. This is the Datanauts podcast. You can find this and all of our shows on iTunes, in your favorite podcatcher, or at packetpushers.net. So welcome to the show, Ethan. So happy and tingly to have you on yet again.
So I'm thinking about that it will taste like a snozberry. And yes, I do adamantly defend that. I mean, if anyone wants to challenge me and say that a snozberry sticker, in fact, does not taste like a snozberry, I will be delighted to take them on. Now, this show, allocation of resources, started because, so I'm here more or less a VMware virgin. I have a lab with a couple of, well, now older ESXi hosts. They're only running 5.5, but I still have the same resource allocation challenges no matter what version of ESXi you might be running. When I'm standing up a VM, it's kind of like, how much memory do I give this thing? How many cores should I give this thing? Should I dedicate a certain amount of memory to it? Can I oversubscribe? If I want to guarantee that this VM has a certain amount of performance, is there some way I can guarantee that? You know, and on the other hand, I'm looking at this, you know, lab box with limited resources, only a certain amount of RAM and a certain amount of cores and so on. I don't want to give a VM too much and just waste resources. I need it to run well, but not... And then vendors, of course, if you're using one of their virtual machines, like some kind of a bundled virtual app, they'll say, well, you need X number of cores and this much memory, or we won't support you, kind of thing. Are they being too greedy? So all this stuff's going through my head that's like, oh my gosh, I could totally do this on a network all day long. I know how to figure out traffic patterns and come up with peak load times and know I should put links here and in this place, and I can double them like this, and I can load manage in this way, so we can oversubscribe this much because of the app pattern. And on a virtual machine, I haven't got a clue, but I know somebody, and that somebody is you. So no pressure, man. Can you teach me the way of the VM resource allocation?
Absolutely. You threw out a lot of interesting questions there, and I think I'll start with this. In most places that I've worked either with or for, it's generally cheaper to just throw hardware at these problems than to try to isolate down to the nitty-gritty, oh, I want to get 99% out of my environment. Most of the time, people will just buy another ESXi host or whatever the hypervisor is, throw it in there. It's quick and cheap. You may be paying 10 to 20 grand for the server and you're done and you have more resources than to try to fix these problems. I'm not necessarily saying that's right, though. I'm just saying that's the typical.
But I'm laughing because in networking, we do very much the same thing. Quality of service is the tool that we would use to manage a link that tends to have too much traffic going through it, and you got to prioritize some traffic over another. Well, baby, there's no QoS like bandwidth. If that pipe's struggling, make a bigger pipe. That's the best way to deal with it, so it's more or less the same solution. Not always the right solution for financial reasons, but oftentimes what people do, because it's easier than trying to actually figure out a policy that's going to make it work with what you got.
Well, I think the heart of your question was really around decision making when you want to provision a workload, either kind of a BYO workload that you're just building for an application or something that's been given to you by a vendor. Like I said earlier in the intro, that's kind of the catch-22. You don't really know until it's up and running what it's going to need. Therefore, how do you size it? I tend to be a totalitarian evil dictatorship when it comes to my virtualized environments. You're working in a lab, so you don't have anyone pushing back on you. If you deploy a virtual machine in the lab and you need to change its size, the change control is you. You just power it off and change the size and everything's good. The reality is most people don't have that luxury in production, in the enterprise, things like that. And so that kind of competition that goes between the app or the tenant or the business unit that wants something into the environment and the person that is responsible for building it and putting it in the environment can be tenuous. I tend to be very cautious and very conservative when it comes to giving resources.
You as the systems engineer, the guy that's you know, controlling, monitoring, understanding what's going on a given host or a set of hosts. You say conservative, does that mean stingy as in, you know, give me a really good reason here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So applications don't typically get built and put directly into production, especially when we're talking about more quote unquote legacy type apps. Like you're not going to build an SAP server or a Cognos server, which are some of the more recent ones in memory for me, and just immediately stick it out there for the world to use. You're typically going to put it in pre-prod. It'll go through the different tiers of development and stage and tests and all that kind of jazz. And so you could be pretty stingy there just to see, is this even going to fulfill the requirements at that level? Maybe you're going to give it a quarter as many CPUs as the vendor might want, or just two cores to start with, just to
see. If you could dedicate 16 cores, that'd be great. Thanks.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much the only hard and fast rule to sizing is never do what was asked of you, unless they want one core, because you can't go lower than that. Most of the requests that I would handle would be something like that, Ethan. Yeah, I need 16 cores and 64 gigabytes of RAM for this file server. And I'd say that's hilarious. You're going to get 2 cores and 4 gigs of RAM, and you will come to me on your knees begging if you need more. And you better have star charts and heuristics and a signed document from the CEO saying you're going to get more. I ruled with an iron fist because it's a choice. You can really just choose what you want to do. But it's certainly better to lean on the side of conservative amount of resource allocation rather than over allocate, because it's like giving out a loan to someone who has kind of a sketchy credit history. You don't know if you're going to get that stuff back. Typically, you're never going to get it back. So I would start very small.
Yeah, it's again, I can draw parallels to networking in that I would have people come to me and say, I need a new DMZ on the firewall for this, or I need new VLANs for this, or I need all new IP addresses for this. Well, why? And then the bluster would start. Come on, give me a good reason. You need an architectural reason that you can justify why you need these things. I can create them, but it creates an administrative burden and technical debt on the organization. So there better be a friggin' good reason that we're doing this. And so you got to justify it. So the being a hard, I get that. I get that logic. So what sort of documentation or expectation would you have of them to determine, okay, I do indeed need to provide them with more RAM or more CPU, whatever it might be?
Pretty much nothing. The requester is not going to know unless they're a very technical person who's worked with this application and has run some kind of bench test against it or did a smoke test or something where it's actually been running. I never believed anything that they said, regardless of who it was.
So just them coming to you and saying, Mr. Wall, Your Majesty, my application's a bit slow. Could you, you know, turn up the volume? That not good enough?
Well, I'll segregate what I said earlier when it comes to provisioning a new workload, just because they have no clue. If they have an issue and they're saying, I need more resources, the idea is hopefully I've already caught that. So I've got something monitoring the environment that would kind of tell me that either at an application level or at kind of a virtual infrastructure level. But yeah, if they're going to come to me and say something's wrong, I'm certainly going to investigate it. But there's no default reaction where it's, oh, it's running slow. Here's more RAM. Blah, it's done. That would never be my first reaction because it's oftentimes wrong. Like 99% of the time, it's not a resource issue. It's the way you configure the resources or the application, or it's somewhere on the network because it's always the network.
Yeah, right. Or it's going after some resource across the network that's part of the flow. Like it's authentication that doesn't happen inside the app. It happens off box. That happens to be slowing things down, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a great example where I ran a pretty large farm of developer workstations for some folks offshore in India. And by developer workstation, they were full copies of Windows Server, with Visual Studio and applications that we're building on these servers. So the word workstations kind of meaningless. So there was a couple hundred guys working offshore, and they complained that the workloads were slow and the desktops were slow, and they would try to get into them and do work. They were really slow, and they always wanted me to give these things more resources. I would see that they're all sitting there pretty much doing nothing. It was the 500 milliseconds of latency from Chicagoland to India that was causing the problem.
Exactly.
So if I had just said, okay, everybody gets more RAM, that would be 270 something odd servers that were acting as workstations, all getting, let's just say, one more gig of RAM. That's a quarter terabyte of RAM that I just gave away for no reason. That's not going to solve anything. So you have to be very conservative with your resources if you're working in a model where it's not a cloudy type of environment, if you're the gatekeeper of those resources.
So, okay, we can be mean. We get that. We're both systems administrators from different perspectives that have had that deep knowledge of our systems to know that just because you asked for it or report this thing doesn't mean that turning up the volume is going to help. You got to study things and you got to understand what's really going on. So in my case, it would be the network. So you mentioned tooling and metrics and this kind of stuff. They would say, well, the network's slow. And I'm like, the network's barely being used, guys. You know, between here and here, there's the two boxes that are talking. There's nothing happening. So, I mean, it isn't the network as far as utilization goes. We got to look deeper to figure out what the problem really is. You know, I have nothing to fix yet. It sounds like the same thing. So, okay, from a VMware perspective, there's charts and performance graphs and things I can be looking at galore. Is that the kind of stuff I should be monitoring to make sure that a VM is performing adequately?
To some degree, I would say yes. The built-in performance information is okay for more, let's say, 5,000-foot view type issues. It just gives you kind of the virtual machine as a container of work. Is it doing good or bad? But it's not going to tell you end-to-end latency for a user that's trying to run an application or the applications talking to one another. If you have an issue between web and middleware, or middleware and backend database, something like that, it's really not going to expose any of that to you.
There's no insight into a multi-tiered app if you're looking at a single VM that's one piece of a much larger puzzle, you're saying.
Right, right. You would need to purchase or use some open source software. Like vRealize Operations tends to be pretty popular for VMware Shop just because it does kind of look across workloads, applications. There's plugins that you can use so that it can suck in data from storage network, the app itself, things like that. And it kind of puzzles it all together. I know VM Turbo is another option. And we talked about recently data center level telemetry with Snap, you know, Intel's open source telemetry software. It's interesting that all of these guys and gals out there are talking about machine learning, but data is data, right? Whether or not it's a computer using the data and doing some kind of activity or learning based on it, or it's you, you need good data. It all starts with having good data as real time as possible, located little sensors everywhere as much as possible. And then you can either run it kind of open source and put it into Grafana as an example, or just shell out some cash because you don't have the resources or the talent to do that in-house and buy something like VROPS or VM Turbo, whatever it is that you like.
Chris, you're talking about graphing a lot of stuff. Okay, again, comparing with networking, we can do the same thing. We can graph stuff all day long. I can graph bandwidth and errors on a particular line and you know, packet drops and you name it, I can graph it. But what I don't have is a system that is intelligent enough to correlate that data and tell me something useful most of the time. So to take a network management provider that's beginning to spread out all over the data center, SolarWinds, they've got all these different things that they can monitor, and they're beginning to put that data together in such a way that you can tell, hey, this storage array is getting slow and there's an application that depends on it, so it may be impacted. And so you kind of get this dependency tree that you can build of all the different things that you're monitoring in your data center and get a little more insight into what's really going on. On the server side, virtualization side, do we have that, or is it you've got a million things you need to be monitoring, and if you know what you're looking for, great, and if you don't, you're kind of screwed?
That's where some of those tools I was talking about come in handy, because traditionally what would happen was you would deploy a tool, it would use vCenter server as the single source of truth, which is not very good because vCenter is pulling the hosts. The hosts are sending performance data to it. It tends to roll up a lot of the data and smooth it out over time. And it's okay for sort of a lick your thumb, stick it in the wind, see how things are blowing, but it's not great for really getting nitty gritty. So what I like to deploy are tools that pull from multiple sources, you know, the infrastructure, the application, anything in between, you know, network and things like that. Correlates it all, but rather than just give me those gas gauges, I remember deploying a lot of different pieces of software that would just tell you, alert, CPU's at 95%. Yeah, ugh, that's exactly. Bad because it's a big number. Largely worthless information that flooded the email. You'd have an email rule to stick it all in a folder and you never looked at that folder. What I want is something that can trend the data, which is where all these modern tools are going towards. Is this normal or not normal? Is this actually affecting performance? Kind of having a robot in the middle that is really just asking, do I care? And in a lot of cases, 95% CPU for a minute, I don't care. It doesn't do anything. Nothing's impacted. Therefore, don't send me these stupid alarms. And the other part of it is, I would say when you're looking for a tool to monitor the data center or just the virtualized infrastructure, it needs to be something that is going to kind of auto-configure itself, right? It can look at the environment, even if it takes 2 or 3 weeks, I'm fine with that, so that it can understand a baseline of what's normal versus what's happening. And I don't have to go in and write 200 stupid little rules saying, this server is at 95% for 7.5 minutes, send an alert to Bob's team. You know, like that's largely a waste of my time. And it means I'm spending a lot of work in one specific tool that I can't reuse somewhere else.
One of our sponsors today is Altero Software. Altero is a developer of backup solutions, specializing in backup for virtualized environments, especially for SMBs. Altero's flagship product is Altero VM Backup. This is a hassle-free backup solution for Hyper-V and VMware virtual machines, and it's trusted by over 30,000 SMBs already. Altero VM Backup is designed with a straightforward user interface and an easy setup where you don't have to beat your head to death against a complex configuration. Altero VM Backup is easy to use, but it is really capable as well. It's got all the features you need to create a rock-solid backup strategy for Hyper-V and for VMware. And the pricing scheme is really straightforward as well. It's priced per host, and it is not per CPU or socket. Altero VM Backup comes with advanced functionality to schedule live VM backups, replicate encrypted backups to an offsite location, and to set automated backup integrity checks. You've also got highly capable restore options. You can restore a whole VM or perform file or exchange level items. For larger environments, all hosts and backups can be managed from one central management console, making it simple to scale and grow your Altero environment. Altero VM Backup is backed by a highly technical support team, and premium support is already included in the license price. You don't have to pay extra for it. So if you're interested in backing up your virtual machines, take a look at Altero VM Backup. It's a solution to easily back up your virtual environment, recover data on those terrible days, and scale with remote management capabilities. Want to know more? Okay, contact Sam Perry. Sam can be reached at sam.perry@altero.com or head over to go.altero.com/datanauts to download a 30-day trial for unlimited VMs. Datanauts listeners are going to get a free Altero t-shirt throughout the month of June 2016. Plus, after the 30-day trial, you can back up 2 virtual machines with Altero for free forever. One more time, that is go.altero.com/datanauts. Well, Chris, I want to move the conversation ahead. We've been talking a bit about just kind of the basics of sizing and resource allocation and some of the real straightforward things where you know you need to add more. If you're doing proper monitoring, you can tell when something's choking because it doesn't have enough CPU and memory, and then you make the appropriate adjustments. And if there's a lot of little apps, that's fine. But what about big, beefy apps, the scary monsters that do need tons of CPU and tons of memory just because they're monolithic, they do a lot of important things, they have a lot of I.O. You know, I'm going to assume that there's more architecture and thinking that goes into that sort of a virtual machine than the smaller ones.
That's one of the beautiful and horrible things about virtualizing workloads is that it's really easy. It's easy to start with. There's not a lot of friction and things run until they don't. You know, like when you put together a virtualized infrastructure, you can screw it up pretty horribly and it'll still run okay. Where you start separating folks that have the experience and the knowledge around virtualizing stuff, I'll use as a generic term, versus those that don't is when you hit a wall where the virtual machine and the applications running within it are so hungry that it just breaks the paradigm of build VM, put app on it, build VM, put app on it, that real easy flow that most folks spend their time doing. A lot of times the issue is these apps move a lot of data around in some way, shape, or form. You measure it in IOPS, measure it in network throughput, latency, whatever it is. They want to get data from A to B in a very performant manner. That's when you start to really hit the wall and say, crap, I don't know how to handle this. There's a couple ways that you can approach these type of things, virtualizing these types of workloads, that is just unique versus every other server you virtualized. So yes, there are considerations around that. It typically focuses on moving data around.
When you say moving data around, we're talking across the network, we're talking to and from storage. What are we getting at specifically?
The three main areas that I tend to focus on are, it's either the disk subsystem itself. So when I'm trying to write or read, there's no local disk, or even if there is, it's kind of abstracted. If I'm using server-side flash as an example, what the virtual machine sees is not an actual local disk. It's a virtualized disk. So the way that it talks to that is quintessential for these really critical apps. It could be the network fabric that's transporting the I/O across the environment, or it could be meeting peak demands because I have a noisy neighbor issue and other applications or workloads are trying to send and receive data at the same time. And you've got a conflict somewhere that you haven't really hit before, such as I'm very lazy and I like to provision as few things as possible when it comes to storage, you know, either a small number of volumes or LUNs, whatever it may be. You can get away with that until you can't, until all of a sudden you've got too many workloads or a very noisy workload trying to consume that resource, and it's at the detriment of others within the environment. Those are often the pain points.
Like you said, it works until it doesn't, meaning if it's a peak load issue, it works most of the time. Then all of a sudden, like, oh my God, for the last 20 minutes, things were really, it's fine again. What the heck happened? That kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's not even that I virtualized something that's monster hungry workload. It could be someone screwed up and there's an errant process just going bonkers on a workload that shouldn't need bonkers amount of IO. And it's just sitting there destroying the environment. And you're like, why is this, I don't know, mail server going crazy? Or why is this file server going crazy? And it's because something happened within the operating system. And as a virtualization administrator, if you're looking at kind of just the infrastructure view, you can't see these things. You just see problem, red lights. I don't know what's going on. What do I do?
So, okay, well, a couple of things here. It sounds like we're talking about designing for peak demand and then knowing what that peak demand is going to be. Again, another same problem in networking. We have to design circuit load and infrastructure with an oversubscription ratio to accommodate peak loads. That's within a data center, and then going outside of the data center on the WANs, where circuits tend to be much more expensive and smaller for what you get, it's the same thing. You have to know, what is my peak load going to be so that this circuit, this precious, expensive commodity, is going to be able to carry it. We don't want to overpay because it costs a lot. And so sizing it just as big as possible isn't really within the realm of possibility. You got to be careful because of the dollars being spent. And so there's a design and there's a study that goes into that to come out with the best product.
In my experience, it boils down to, you know, I talked about moving data. So it really boils down to how we're going to talk to disk and how we're going to run our compute as compared to where the memory is at. So I guess we'll talk about the first one first.
So wait a second here. You're saying talking to disk is such a common bottleneck that you really need to focus on that?
It's almost always the issue from my experience, especially working with data warehousing applications and those big Cognos, PeopleSoft, those kind of things. It's pretty much always disk access and the way you construct the workload to be very poorly designed for disk access.
Reading, writing files, reading, writing database transactions, other sorts of common disk operations?
Yes, everything kind of boils down to an I/O. And if we take a step back, it's really about queues and queue depths. And these are terms that I don't think a lot of virtualization administrators really spend a lot of time noodling on. Quite frankly, if you've just done kind of generic virtualization, you don't care about queues because they're extracted away and you don't see them. A queue depth is really just the value of the number of I/O requests, you know, any input-output operations or SCSI commands that are allowed to be queued at one time. And there's actually something on the order of like 7 or 8 different I/O queues for a virtual machine to traverse through when it goes to read or write data. So there's a lot of potential choke points.
This is because the virtual machine is not actually talking to the disk directly. The host is. The virtual machine is talking through these abstracted layers first, yeah?
Right. The guest operating system feels that it's using a local SCSI device, right? So it just thinks it's issuing commands to something attached to its bus. And that's the point, is you don't have to expose all this complexity to the guest operating system. You don't want to. Mm-hmm. But when it sends an I/O, you know, it goes through, within the vSphere realm, the VMM, which goes to the virtual SCSI layer, which goes to the storage stack. It's got to then talk to the drivers on the HBA, hit some kind of fabric. Then the storage array has queues, depending on how its controllers are put together. It's not too dissimilar to the idea behind Fibre Channel, where you've got buffers in place and you want to make sure that you don't overconsume the credits for those buffers. Just from a 10,000-foot view, there's a lot of different buffers in place with Fibre Channel to get data from A to B. And that could be what you're using as the transport fabric for the guest operating system or something like NFS. But long story short, there's a lot of different places where these buffers, these queues, have different sizes. They fill up at different rates. And even layers like the storage stack and the driver layer and the HBA layer, all the virtual machines on the host are sharing that. The virtual SCSI layer, that's dedicated to the virtual SCSI device, which could be virtualized or emulating some other device, like LSI SAS drivers as an example. But you've got different places where there's sharing going on, no sharing going on, all the way down to the storage array where the I.O. is actually handled, acknowledged, and then if something's been read or written, that data comes back and says, yes, we acknowledge I wrote that for you, or if it's a read, hey, here's the data you're looking for.
So how can I tell when I've got performance issues there? Because as you said, a lot of this is abstracted away from the virtual machine. So if storage is my bottleneck, how do I figure that out?
Typically, you're going to want to look at various average commands if you use something like ESXTOP in the VMware world. And that's going to tell you where this latency may be. So it's going to tell you the perspective of the guest operating system itself. You know, what does it see? What about the kernel within the hypervisor? What does it see? Or just the device? And it's going to measure the average latency or the average number of commands that can be committed between those different realms so that you can see where's the bottleneck. Because if it's a guest issue, if the guest sees a lot of latency but the device doesn't see a lot of latency, it could be that there's some kind of issue at the higher level of the stack within the virtual SCSI layer or the operating system or the application. Whereas if the kernel's seeing some kind of latency, it's more at the storage stack and the driver layer, et cetera. So there's all these different ways you can see where the latency may be and the queue depths related to them. And there's some different storage technologies that you can consume, like storage I/O control, that'll help you maintain fairness amongst different hosts that are sharing the same data storage.
Kind of blowing my mind here just a little bit. I just want to back up because you're talking about the different layers. I would not have guessed that there could be latency unique to the virtualized layer. My obviously incorrect logic is this. You've got a physical device at the end of this chain, right? At the bottom of the layer, there's this physical device that's actually doing reads and writes, performing I/O operations, and it's got to be the bottleneck ultimately. You couldn't have a bottleneck higher up in the stack. I mean, it would be like misleading. Ultimately, it would have to come down to the physical device, but it sounds like I'm wrong.
Yeah, you could have, as an example, let's say you have two VMware hosts running ESXi, and they are connected to the same storage device. So the storage array, you know, the storage device could be like, hey, everything's cool. I don't see a lot of activity going on. Because one of the two hosts is issuing a bajillion small I/O requests and clogging up the queue of the HBA or the storage stack on the host. And therefore, the virtual machines on that first host are seeing a lot of latency. It takes them forever to kind of get out of the traffic jam that's occurring within the host. Whereas the other host is like, things are great. I have nothing clogging me up. I can get directly to storage. Storage sees just a trickle of I/O kind of coming from the first host because it's so jammed up. Therefore, it says everything's cool, and the problem's more at the host layer of that first ESXi host because there's an issue there. That's one of those issues that can be assuaged by using storage I/O control because it'll actually, on the fly, adjust the queue depth for the virtual machines. So it gives them a smaller piece of the pie of the overall queue depth available on the HBA, as an example. And that way, if one is going bonkers, it gets kind of compressed down into a smaller queue that's equal to the queue on the other hosts for those other virtual machines. But this is really only something that works if they're sharing the storage device. If they're using different ones, it doesn't really do anything.
Well, that's actually a huge thing that you just brought home to me is the reminder that these are shared resources. And depending on what layer you're at, they're shared in different ways amongst different objects, if you will, within the system. And so As soon as you remember that something's being shared, then you can create contention and excessive latency. That just brought a lot of things home for me. Thank you for that.
Yeah, and here's the most common one. So if you're listening at home or on your ride or something like that, and you're working with larger or more transactional type workloads, a lot of folks don't realize that when you create a virtual machine within VMware, it's going to give it one virtual SCSI device. Paravirtual is a very common one to use. LSI Logic or LSI SAS are other ones that are less common, kind of fading away over time. But that also has its own queue depth associated with it. It's the amount of I/O that's going to let that device send down the stack towards the driver, the HBA, the fabric, et cetera. And so when you're working with something that's highly transactional or has a very mixed I/O pattern, maybe one virtual disk attached to the virtual SCSI device is doing a lot of reads, or very small reads. The other one's doing very large writes, maybe a database that's doing 64K writes and a lot of small reads of something else. If you mix those together and you only have one virtual SCSI device, it could really cause a traffic jam. You know, these 64K writes are kind of waiting behind these little tiny reads. because an I/O is an I/O. It doesn't matter the size of it. It's going to consume the same amount of queue. So you can actually create 4 virtual SCSI devices per virtual machine, and you can use that to demarcate different types of I/O pattern. So you could give the system drive and maybe some kind of read-heavy disk device to the first virtual SCSI device, you know, the first pair of virtual SCSI device, make a second one and attach the more write-heavy device to that. And that way, you make multiple lanes of traffic to get to the storage array for a virtual machine, and you can do up to 4 of those per virtual machine. For databases, it's a very common design to make multiple SCSI devices and attach the different I/O patterns of disk for log and database and things like that to them.
We've kind of parked here on storage because you said it's typically what the problems are when there's a big, scary application that's not doing well. Storage is at the root of it. But I mean, outside of storage, is there anything worth bringing up?
Yeah, my good friend Numa, the non-uniform memory access, is pretty much the only other common gotcha, because the hypervisor is going to expose the number of logical cores, and hyperthreading is a very common thing, as well as using memory placement per socket. To back it up a little bit, let's say you had a 2-socket box, 2 Intel chips inside of there somewhere. They're going to have memory banks associated with them. So the first socket will have half the RAM directly connected to it, or it'd be some very low latency connection so that it can consume that RAM. The other socket will have a direct connection to its RAM. And the idea behind NUMA is typically when an application's spun up, it's just going to kind of saturate the RAM very evenly when it starts to need to use it, right? So it'll just kind of float across all the different DIMMs that are in there, regardless of where it's at, regardless of what socket it's attached to, and just start placing the pages that it needs into those DIMMs. With NUMA, we state that based on what the machine's doing, how many virtual cores it has assigned to it, which translate into physical and logical cores on the chip, we're going to only use RAM on that particular socket. And that way, we don't have to use what's called a QPI, the Quick Path Interconnect, to get from one socket to the next, which is a bottleneck. It would be kind of like in the world of networking, like a trombone going from data center A to over to data center B and then back to A for no real reason, if everything you need is on data center A anyways. The problem there is that a lot of folks with older hardware didn't have NUMA necessarily enabled. So you would have requests coming from a workload on socket 0, which is the first one, but it's using RAM on socket 1, which is the second one. Therefore, every time I need to execute something on socket 0, I have to use the QPI to go fetch the pages on socket 1, go to the DIMM, grab the data, put it back over the QPI, and then run something against it. And that QPI is relatively small, so there's not a lot of bandwidth to go relatively. And there's additional latency because memory is very fast. You want nanoseconds of latency, not milliseconds or anything like that. So enabling NUMA, making sure that you're using non-uniform memory access is a really good thing if you're doing SMP, the symmetric multiprocessing.
Well, hang on a second. So just enabling NUMA, where is that magical checkbox?
That's typically in the host BIOS. So in the actual server BIOS, you would make sure that it's a feature that's on modern servers today, out of the box, just come with it. They typically call it disabling NUMA. So like there'll be a feature saying, it's a very reverse logic statement, but essentially you disable NUMA, which enables it, which sounds weird, but when you read the verbiage in the BIOS, you'll see it. And then by default, when the hypervisor sees that you have multiple sockets, it will make sure that when it spins up the vCPUs, they're on the same socket using the same memory on that side. You can actually see what's called the NUMA locality percentage, which tells you, let's say you've got 8 cores on the first socket and you spin up a 4 vCPU virtual machine, you'll be able to go into ESXTop and it'll say, okay, cool. All 4 of these cores are running on socket 0. Therefore, the NUMA locality is 100% because we're using only so much RAM and it's smaller than the total amount of RAM available on socket 0. Where you run into issues is when someone tries to build a virtual machine that's relatively low on CPU count, but high on memory count, such that if I only have 128 gigabytes of RAM on socket 0 and I make a virtual machine that has more than 128 gigs of RAM, the hypervisor has no choice but to start consuming RAM from the other socket. Therefore, your NUMA locality percentage will go down. It might be 90% or something like that. And if it's a very memory-heavy or memory-intensive type workload and you're having to traverse the QPI constantly, you'll see performance degradation. So be mindful of the CPU count when you provision as well as the size of the memory.
Storage, I can see being a very obvious bottleneck. It's a slow medium anyway. It's got to traverse a wire. It's got to be written to physical disk, etc. But is enabling NUMA and avoiding that QPI bottleneck that significant of a performance gain?
It really depends on, it sounds so consulting of me to say that. Depends on how many other things are using the QPI, first and foremost. If you have one workload and all the rest are local, the QPI is kind of sitting there mostly idle anyway. So it's not a huge deal. How often the application uses the local cache right? So if I'm using, the caches are extremely, extremely fast. You know, L1, L2 cache are lightning quick. If I'm having to use that somewhere else, as an example, and then get memory on the other side, I'm really taking a process that's supposed to be nearly instantaneous and slowing it down by 2, 3, or even 4 magnitudes of speed. And so you'll notice with something that's either really working with a large data set and needs to crunch that quite quickly, or just something where you're looking at your locality percentages and it looks really off because people are requesting these giant virtual machines, you'll notice some performance there. But I think you're right. The disk is almost always an issue. This one is more about making sure that we're not kind of messing up the host configuration. If we mess this up more and more, the QPI will get more and more saturated, and that's when things really start to hurt. Just one or two, not a big deal.
Sponsorship break, folks. We're going to talk about IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV gives you access to the most important tools needed to prepare you for IT certification. I've been to the site. I visited. I viewed a number of the videos. It is the real deal. You get 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content. New courses are added every single week. And you can consume these courses either live, because they're actually running live sessions you can tune into, or on demand. You can look at the archives, go through the library, and pick anything you want to. And you can view these with anything that you can imagine, Chromecast, Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, etc., of course, through the web in a browser or with your mobile device. Now, if you've heard this ad before, listen up. Here's some new stuff. IT Pro TV is now the first IT video provider with courses for sale through Amazon Video Direct. So subscriptions are still going to be the best value for you, but it's kind of cool that IT Pro TV is now available for purchase directly on Amazon. Now, if you're wondering, why do I care? What content have they got? They've got all the big stuff, the big names, like Microsoft Server 2016, MCSE. They cover ethical hacking. They get into virtualization, a lot of VMware content in there, cryptography, Metasploit, other such things that would be of immediate value to you if you're an infrastructure or security engineer, etc. Now, June courses, content that they've added here includes CCNA security from Cisco, VMware's VCP6, and then instructor Adam Gordon returns with Certified Ethical Hacker version 9. It's not just course material you get with IT Pro TV. You also get well over 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs and then Transcender practice exams so that you know you're really ready to go take the real thing. And that's $109 value. All of that is rolled into one low monthly subscription price. And if you decide at some point, I don't want this anymore, they have a no-hassle cancellation policy. And by the way, corporate group pricing is available. Check out itpro.tv/datanauts to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/datanauts. Use the code DATANAUTS30 and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account.
All right, Ethan, I've been babbling enough about performance and bottlenecks and all the creepy crawly stuff that no one likes to face. What do you think so far? Do you think that's just more of the legacy type world that's going away, or is this still relevant to folks?
I mean, it is relevant to people that are working on this stuff today, right? I mean, people are provisioning virtual machines. VMware is still the dominant way to dominant hypervisor upon which to host an app, and people live and work in those environments. Okay. But I do think it is kind of state of the art when much of the world is now looking ahead. What's next? I mean, I see this as we're dealing with big fat VMs, really what you were describing, full operating systems with an application service of some kind layered on top. But tomorrow, we're talking about containers being the norm. Maybe unikernels are going to step in there and be a normal thing too. Containers and unikernels having a much smaller footprint, a way smaller resource requirement per container than versus virtual machine. And so I think how we are going to end up having to deal with resource allocation and dealing with resource contention will be a little different. I think the problem is still going to be there, but it's going to get solved in some different way. And I don't know that we've nailed it yet. You know, going back towards the beginning of the show, you mentioned people don't tend to spend too much time on this. If the system's out of CPU and out of memory, just buy another one. Don't spend a lot of time tweaking VMs to try to get your resource allocation back in spec. Just throw hardware at the problem. And that seems to be what's going on now in the container world. I mean, from what I'm hearing as I talk to different folks who are in this space, the orchestrated way to deal with resource allocation challenges is monitor some telemetry data, which is kind of coarse. There's not that many super detailed options necessarily yet. Monitor some telemetry data for some exceeded thresholds of specific microservices. And then, oh, we've exceeded a threshold. My gosh, let's spin up more containers. Off we go. Which doesn't seem terribly nuanced to me. Kind of a really blunt hammer. On the other hand, if it's just cheap x86 boxes, do we care? You know, I'm not sure. I mean, do you think I'm wrong in that assessment? Or,
you know, having kind of sat in the middle a little bit, dealing with some of the newer stuff and a lot of the older stuff, I have to give the nod to virtualized infrastructure for having really good resource schedulers. You know, in VMware, it's the distributed resource scheduler, or DRS, is sitting there looking at, are we able to feed the right resources to what needs it? You know, it's not looking to make this perfect balance, but it's trying to make sure that everyone's getting enough to eat at the buffet of resources, which is something we kind of take for granted. Yeah, we are talking about, in the earlier part of the show, big fat virtual machines or something that needs a big fat amount of resources at least. And I certainly like that we're kind of pushing things towards a more distributed model, less of those, let's set up physical mode RDMs and build a crusty old SQL cluster and meh, it's on there forever. And more of a, oh, let's just build a distributed model with always on availability groups for Exchange as an example. But we really need to give the nod to the resource scheduling that's available with these virtualized infrastructures. When we talk to folks doing Kubernetes and other schedulers, their biggest challenge right now is they can only decide where to run something, whether or not it's quote unquote serverless, meaning, you know, it's just some kind of process running on a node somewhere or not, based on the initial creation of it. And you have to have a very stateless app, has to be very lightweight, has to be kind of engineered for that. There's nothing really monitoring in real time where all this stuff is and moving it around when necessary. And that's something that the VMware community, it's not even just taken for granted. It's a necessary thing that we're just totally used to. And so that's where I see the biggest gap right now. And I think the work the folks at Intel are doing with Snap is the beginning of that process of saying, now we have the information to determine where to run stuff. We can begin intelligently scheduling beyond just that initial creation point and more to the life cycle of running something. Because not every application is going to be able to take advantage of the, oh, this host is now totally overused on resources. I'll just destroy this instance of it and build it somewhere else. That's a bit of a luxury for a lot of applications I deal with. All right, I'm going to get down off my soapbox a little bit. I think we had a good noodling on the end there. And that's it for today's edition of the Data Knots podcast. Hey, if you're a social creature, and I'm pretty sure you are, you can follow me. I'm at Chris Wall on the Twitters, or my blog, wallnetwork.com. Or hey, my delightful friend, Ethan, he's at ecbanks on the Twitters, and his blog is ethancbanks.com. For more of that awesome Data Knots that you know and love, where we talk about infrastructure engineering, nosedive down the rabbit hole that is packetpushers.net. You'll find the Data Knots talking about containers and conferences and certifications, oh my, including PowerShell and moving to the cloud and all sorts of other snazzy stuff. Until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed. Am I like the odd man out? I'm an other category using Arista? I thought it was popular. I was wrong.
Oh, that's on us.
Way to go, buddy.
I said us.
Buddy as a plural verb. I don't know. Words?
I believe that's pronounced buddies.
Nope.